save ye even more.
Meat maiden, bring...
In a surprise move, the Supreme Court decides not to take up gay marriage, clearing the way for same-sex couples to wed in at least five more states. Good evening, I'm Gwen Ifill. Judy Woodruff is away. Also ahead this Monday, a fifth American stricken with Ebola lands in the U.S. as the first patient diagnosed here fights for his life. Plus, high school football under the spotlight after three young players die within a single week. We talk to players and coaches about violence and the game they love.
Like, you know that when you go out there and suit up, every time you suit up could be your last time. I say, yeah, I know that, but I say it's not something you think about. And even when you do think about it, you dismiss it because those type of thoughts in your head make you second guess yourself.
Those are just some of the stories we're covering on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
Economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us.
And by BAE Systems, inspired work.
The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
The Supreme Court opened for business today and immediately ruled out a major decision on gay marriage. Instead, without comment, the justices refused to hear cases from five states. Within hours, same-sex weddings were underway in Virginia, with the path now clear for ceremonies to begin in the other states as well.
I hereby declare you legally married.
For gay couples in Utah who married in a 17-day window of legality last December, the high court's move came as a happy surprise.
It means my marriage is going to be legal and my second parent adoption for my son can go through. And I think what it also means is it will be very difficult to put the toothpaste back in the tube if anybody decides to try to deny rights, which they shouldn't under the Constitution.
The court's action immediately allowed weddings in five states: Virginia, Indiana, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, and Utah. All had appealed lower court rulings against gay marriage bans. Six other states are bound by those same rulings, and couples there will ultimately be able to marry as well. They'll join 19 other states and the District of Columbia, where gay marriage is already legal. Utah Governor Gary Herbert said today he's still opposed, but the fight is essentially over.
I do personally believe that it is a state right issue. I believe that in the past and believe it today. But, you know, people have different points of view and different opinions. But right now, it's a matter of standing down, so there's no more expense.
The road to legalizing gay marriage has been a long one, from civil unions to actual marriages, starting in Massachusetts in 2004. That evolution came amid a sea change in public opinion. Polling since 1996 has shown an upward tick in support for same-sex marriage, and for the past 4 years, it's been over 50%. 2 years ago, President Obama weighed in.
At a certain point, I've just concluded that, for me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
What do we want?
Equality!
And last year, gay rights advocates celebrated as the Supreme Court struck down part of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. We'll get a full analysis of the impact of today's Supreme Court action, including voices on either side of the gay marriage question, right after the news summary. In other news, three neuroscientists will share this year's Nobel Prize for Medicine for work that could lead to advances in diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. British-American John O'Keefe and two Norwegians, Edvard and May-Britt Moser, discovered a kind of inner GPS system that helps humans orient themselves. Edvard Moser spoke today in Germany, where he was traveling.
We're just trying to find out how the brain works. And that is extremely important on a more long-term perspective, because if we find the basic principles that that control how the brain operates, we'll be able to, in the long term, to treat every kind, all kinds of neurological and psychiatric diseases.
The three Nobel laureates will share the prize of about $1.1 million. In Syria, Islamic State forces pressed even closer to a key Kurdish town near the Turkish border. Fighting raged around Kobani all through the weekend, with the militants blasting away with artillery and mortars. Today, plumes of smoke rose from shell hits, and black Islamic State flags appeared on hilltops and buildings on the eastern side of the town. Kurdish forces said they still hold the city's center. The protests that gridlocked downtown Hong Kong appeared to wane today, and the city returned to work. Pro-democracy demonstrators numbered only a few hundred, and they'd pulled back barricades blocking the main business district. In a televised statement today, Hong Kong's leader urged the remaining protesters to go home.
There are lots of teenagers and students with passion who love Hong Kong who are taking part in various gatherings. However, some of them are aggressive and using violence. The police will firmly take enforcement action against those who use violence.
Talks have begun between the government and activists, but some protest leaders are vowing to stand their ground until demands for fully free elections are met. A presidential runoff campaign kicked off today in Brazil, where Latin America's largest economy has been stagnating. Leftist incumbent Dilma Rousseff is seeking a second term. She won 42% in Sunday's first round. Challenger Aécio Neves is a pro-business candidate who surged late in the campaign and won 34%. Struggling tech giant Hewlett-Packard confirmed today it plans to split into two companies. HP will separate its computer and printer businesses into one, while the other focuses on technology services, including data storage and software. Like other PC makers, HP has labored to keep pace as customers shift to smartphones and tablets and away from desk and laptops. Wall Street started the week on a down note amid uncertainty about interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 17 points to close below 16,992. The Nasdaq fell more than 20 points to close at 4,454, and the S&P 500 shed 3 to finish at 1964. And a death of note in the entertainment world. Dancer, actor, and choreographer Jeffrey Holder passed away Sunday in New York. At 6'6", he cut a striking figure on stage and screen. In 1975, he won Tony Awards for directing and designing the costumes for The Wiz, an all-black update of The Wizard of Oz. He also played a James Bond villain in Live and Let Die. Along the way, a TV commercial gave him an even higher profile.
For an equal refreshment, the Un's the one. 7-Up, the Un cooler.
Jeffrey Holder was 84 years old. Still to come on the News Hour, is it a new day for same-sex marriage in America? A spotlight on efforts to contain Ebola at home and abroad. When head injuries turn deadly in high school football, a best-selling author on bringing magic to life, and remembering Lady Bird Johnson's historic whistle stop tour through the South. We return now to the Supreme Court's decision today not to take up same-sex marriage with Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal. Big day today at the court, Marcia.
Very interesting, Gwen.
Was it a surprise to you?
Yes, it was. I mean, conventional wisdom from court scholars, litigators, was that the court was ready. It was going to take one of the cases that it had pending.
So we don't really know why they didn't.
We don't. And when the court issues a decision not to hear a case, as it did today, it generally doesn't comment unless there's a dissent from that decision. So we don't know what went on in the minds of the justices. And we're also told with these kind of decisions not to read too much into them. But that didn't stop speculation today.
And does it settle things or does it unsettle things?
Speculation about why the justices did what they did. And I think there are two schools of thoughts here. First of all, the three federal appellate courts that have ruled thus far have struck down bans that states enacted. Justice Ginsburg suggested earlier this summer that the court may want to wait until there's a ruling upholding a state ban. That creates what we call a split among the circuits, and it gives the justices the benefits of full reasoning on both decisions. We're waiting right now for rulings out of the Sixth Circuit, which may very well provide that conflict. And then the second school of thought is maybe a little more strategic inside the court, and it goes back to the 2013 ruling when a 5-4 court struck down the definition of marriage in the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. The four dissenters were the court's most conservative members. It may be that when they went into conference on the new petitions on same-sex marriage, that those four did not see a fifth vote to go their way to uphold states' rights.
Wouldn't it have just taken one of them in order to bring this, to take this, this
yes,
case, these cases?
Yes, but they have to look down the road. If they grant review, what's the point if they can't get that fifth vote for a majority and might instead take a case that could result in a broad national ruling that they don't want?
Let's walk through some of these states and the immediate impact. In the Fourth Circuit, we're talking about Virginia, Indiana, and Wisconsin. We already saw some marriages begin today.
Now, in the Fourth Circuit, actually, you're right, it is Virginia, but the Fourth Circuit also covers North Carolina, West Virginia, and Maryland. Maryland already has legal same-sex marriages. Almost immediately after the decision not to hear the case, the Fourth Circuit, the Federal Appellate Court, lifted its issued its mandate, its decision that marriages could go forward. We also saw motions made in for the North Carolina and West Virginia cases to allow same-sex marriages to go forward. We'll see the same thing happening
in
the Tenth Circuit, which had only two states before it at the time, Utah and Oklahoma. The other states that are within the Tenth Circuit, as well as the states that are within the Seventh Circuit that ruled in Indiana and Wisconsin, those lower federal appellate courts are bound by the decisions of their federal appellate courts. So we can see probably same-sex marriages going forward in those states as well. That's how we get from the five states that the court dealt with today, the Supreme Court, to the 11 states that are likely to allow same-sex marriages going forward.
And added to that, 19 more states.
That's right.
Who haven't been challenged, and so we're talking about a majority of the states.
We are.
And the District of Columbia.
30 states and the District of Columbia.
So I know you try to resist reading too much into the tea leaves here, but I do wonder if you see signs, based on your understanding of the way the court operates, between what we saw last year with the Defense of Marriage Act and their stepping away, at least for now, from these cases, that the court is, I don't know, paying attention to popular opinion?
Well, it may well be that it sees the trend in the lower federal courts that these bans are falling and doesn't see any urgency right now to step in, allow more states to deal with the more federal courts and states to deal with the issue. There are cases still coming up that we will probably see at the Supreme Court. And at that point, we'll have to see what the court does. It may be ready. It may not be ready to step in again.
Always potential for surprise. Marcia Coyle.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Gwen.
So we turn now to two guests who have been fighting hard on both sides of the issue. Evan Wolfson, president of the gay rights group Freedom to Marry, and Austin Nimix, senior counsel for the conservative group Alliance Defending Freedom. Welcome to you both. Evan Wolfson, is this a watershed moment in a good way for you?
It is unquestionably a watershed moment for the country. Already, couples are getting married in five more states, actually six, with Colorado following the lead. As Marcia just said, we now have brought the Freedom to Marry effectively to 30 states. covering 60% of the American people. That's almost two-thirds of the American people soon and living in a state where gay people can share in the freedom to marry. And it's also an unmistakable signal from the Supreme Court to the lower courts and to the other courts and states saying that there is no reason for denying the freedom to marry any longer and they should move forward. But at the same time, though a glass 60% full is better than the alternative, there are 20 states where people are still discriminated against, still being harmed, and it's time for the country to come together in national resolution in favor of the freedom to marry.
Well, let's get back on that patchwork question. But first, I want to ask Austin Nimmicks about something we heard the governor of Utah say today, which is, hey, I still believe what I believe, but it's not worth the money to defend this anymore.
Well, he had a ruling go directly against him, and as Evan just mentioned, there are still 20 states out there. There's litigation across the country. We have four federal circuits that have not yet chimed in on this particular question, the 6th, the 5th, the 8th, and the 11th. And so we're a long way from having any form of national resolution on this question. And Americans are going to continue to debate this regardless of what the Supreme Court does or does not do. And if we are going to step forward as a nation, I think it's important that this question be answered by Americans and not be imposed by judicial fiat. That's really the most unfortunate thing about today's decision, is that we have judges making decisions on questions that Americans are perfectly capable of answering.
Would you have felt the same way if the court had ruled the other way, had decided to take these cases and ended up on your side?
Absolutely, because the court would be taking and reviewing cases where federal courts had imposed their will against the will of the people. And the people are mature enough and understand enough to debate the questions about marriage and make decisions. Do we want laws that affirm mothers and fathers? Do we not care about mothers and fathers? These are some of the things Americans are talking about, and they need the freedom to continue to do that.
Evan,
the fact of the matter is...
Go ahead.
Yeah, the American people have indeed been talking about who gay couples are and why marriage matters and the love and commitment in these families, and have come out in favor of the freedom to marry. 59% of the American people support the freedom to marry. We did a poll last week in Utah, the reddest of red states, and showed a plurality, 49%. Favoring the freedom to marry. The courts are following where the people are, but in fact, what we have in this country is a constitution that says that not everything should be put up to a vote. And it matters to couples who are being denied day to day. They don't have time to wait for some unanimous vote of everybody to treat them the same under the one constitution that protects all of us.
Austin Nimmicks, one of the things Marcia said is that there are other shoes yet to drop. Is that what you're counting on?
So, yeah, there's a lot that's left to happen as far as that's concerned. Like I mentioned, you have the four circuits and the 20 states who are continuing to debate this issue and litigate it in the courts. And we are looking, I mean, there are federal courts that have ruled in favor of marriage. The Eighth Circuit has ruled in favor of marriage. A Louisiana federal judge ruled in favor of marriage. We've seen courts in Tennessee and Mississippi rule in favor of marriage. This is not over with by any stretch of the means.
Do you have any sense that, one second, I'll be right back with you, Evan, but does it feel at all to you like there's a sense of inevitability that's kicking in here?
Well, the only thing that's inevitable is that the Supreme Court can't settle this issue any more than it settled the question of abortion in this country. If the Supreme Court ultimately wants to drop a shoe and say, we're going to impose same-sex marriage in all 50 states, the American people can choose to accept it or not, in the same way that they've chosen to reject the Roe against Wade decision. So this decision is going to continue to be debated and dealt with by Americans who are living marriage every day. We don't need courts to impose its will against the people or take it away from the people. If the people want to change marriage laws, let them change marriage laws like they've done legitimately in other states. We don't need federal judges doing it for us.
Evan Wilson, this is an interesting point, which you're the one who brought up the question of this being a patchwork still in place. Is that an acceptable way to move forward?
Absolutely not. People who live in the United States live under one constitution. We're all individuals. We all have those same freedoms and rights and protections. And we all have the same aspirations to love and commitment and building a life together. And marriages should not sputter in and out like cell phone service, depending on which state people happen to be in. We're one country with one constitution. And the reason we have courts is that sometimes when there is discrimination, sometimes when the politicians get it wrong, we have courts and a constitution to guarantee those freedoms. But you know something? This is a happy moment where what the courts are doing is catching up to where the country is. Mr. Nimitz talked about a handful of judges who went the other way. There are more than 40 state and federal courts that have looked at this question, now including the U.S. Supreme Court, and have said there is no good reason to continue this discrimination.
Let me ask about the U.S. Supreme Court, and let's take a step back from this. Does a ruling or a non-ruling like today affect the Roberts legacy, the legacy of the Roberts Court in your mind, Austin Nimitz?
Well, I think that's a good question that may be a bit premature at this point, because as Marcia said, this is far from over with. I mean, the Supreme Court stepping away from this first wave of cases doesn't mean it's going to step away from the second wave of cases or the third wave of cases. So it's a little early to see what the court's legacy is on this. What we're hopeful for is that the court's legacy on this question will be one of restoring the question to the American people. If they want to vote in same-sex marriage, let them vote in same-sex marriage the way they've done in several states. If they want to maintain marriage as one man and one woman, let them do that. And different states differing is the most American thing we can have in this country. States differ on all kinds of important legal questions all the time. That's what makes America great.
Evan Wilson on the Roberts legacy piece.
Yeah, well, first of all, what makes America great is that we have a constitution that protects liberty and justice for all and treats all of us equally and guarantees that equality, doesn't put it up to a vote. Your freedom of religion, my freedom of speech, getting put up to a vote. We have basic freedoms, and that's why we have a constitution. But fortunately, we also have hearts and minds that when people listen to the real stories of real families and look at their love and look at the joy that's spilling out now in Utah, in Oklahoma, in the other states that we've won today, and they see families helped and no one hurt, the American people, like the courts, have affirmed the freedom to marry. And I think it will be in the Roberts Court's interest also to put its stamp on this movement in our country in the same way that the Supreme Court, having ducked interracial marriage at first, embraced the freedom to marry in the Loving decision two generations ago. I think that is where we're headed. And whether it's through the multiple lower courts that are ruling in our favor or through the Supreme Court, we're going to keep working until we've brought the freedom to marry home nationwide.
Evan Wilson of Right to Marry and Austin Nimitz of the Center for Marriage and Family at Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
President Obama spent part of this day focusing again on the government's response to the Ebola outbreak in Africa and measures to contain it from spreading here in the U.S., including how airline passengers will be screened for symptoms. Jeffrey Brown has more on today's developments.
It is important for
It was the latest bid to reassure an anxious public. The president meeting with top national security and health advisors.
Here in the United States, at least, the chances of an outbreak of an epidemic here are extraordinarily low. But let's keep in mind that as we speak, there are children on the streets dying of this disease, thousands of them.
The president said he'll pressure other large nations to step up and help West African countries now struggling to control the outbreak. The meeting came hours after an infected journalist arrived in Omaha, Nebraska for treatment. Ashoka Mukpo fell ill last week while freelancing for NBC News in Liberia. In Dallas, the first person diagnosed with Ebola inside the U.S. remained in critical condition. Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital said Thomas Eric Duncan of Liberia is now receiving an experimental drug. And in Austin, Governor Rick Perry called for stricter measures to keep Ebola out of the U.S.
Customs officials and Border Patrol agents at all points of entry should immediately be directed to conduct enhanced screening procedures, obtaining more information about people who are coming from affected areas, taking appropriate steps upon arrival.
Hospitals nationwide are now on alert. So far, no other cases have turned up. In Spain, however, officials announced a nurse in Madrid caught Ebola from a priest who got sick in Sierra Leone and was flown home. It's the first case in which the virus was transmitted from person to person outside West Africa.
And for the latest on the situation, we're joined by Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health. He's one of the government's top point people on Ebola. Well, welcome back, Dr. Fauci. The president spoke this afternoon of some new steps to better screen travelers. What kind of things are officials looking at?
Well, the officials are looking now at the possibility of what we call entry screening. Right now, currently, if you're in a West African country and you go to an airport to try and get on a plane to go anywhere, including the United States, you get your temperature taken and you get a questionnaire about how you feel and your possible exposures. What's being considered now is that should there be more on the other end, on the arrival end? Should there be an additional layer of screening? And that's something that's been open for discussion and that is being discussed right now about what the pros and the cons of the added extra effort and investment to do some sort of entry-type screening. That certainly was one of the items on the agenda of the discussion at the White House.
After what happened in Dallas, are you confident or more confident now that protocols are in place at hospitals around the country to detect and respond to any potential new cases?
Yeah, I am, Jeff. I'm fairly certain that that is going to happen. The CDC, for some time now, has been giving out these health alert networks, which are instructions about what you do or what you should do if someone comes in with symptoms compatible with Ebola, that you should ask a travel history and act on it accordingly if you get certain types of information. I think with all the publicity about what went on when there was that misstep in Dallas about losing those 2 days when the person first came to the emergency room, I think any emergency room physician or in a clinic now is very much aware of making sure they ask the right questions.
And what about protecting healthcare workers themselves? Now we have this news out of what appears to have happened in Madrid with a nurse getting Ebola from someone brought there to a hospital, I gather. Are you concerned? Are you more optimistic about the protocols here in this country?
Well, I am. I know that if the protocols are followed carefully, we have an extensive experience from Doctors Without Borders. They follow the protocols. There's rare that they ever get anyone that gets infected. It's unfortunate that the Spanish nurse got infected as part of the care team for the Spanish priest who was taken from West Africa to Spain. But that happens. Sometimes there's a breach in protocol. Hopefully that would be a very, very rare event.
There's also news out of Dallas with Thomas Eric Duncan, who's being cared for there, that he's now being given an experimental drug. What do you know about that?
Right. The experimental drug that Mr. Duncan is receiving is brincidofovir, which is a type of an analog of a drug called cidofovir, which has been used in another kind of viral infection. It is still in the experimental stage with regard to Ebola, but it has been given in other situations. So hopefully there'll be some activity. We don't know yet because it's still experimental.
But the drug we'd heard about earlier, ZMapp, apparently no more of that. Now we hear about an experimental drug. Is there more in the pipeline? Because of what's going on?
There are several drugs, Jeff, that are in the pipeline. There's the Tecmira drug, which is an inhibitory molecule. There's a drug called BCX4430, which is a molecule and a drug that blocks the building blocks of the genetic makeup of the virus. So there are several that are at the experimental stage. The brincidofovir that Mr. Duncan got was one of those in the experimental stage.
All right, just in our last minute, I want to ask you about something else on the minds of many Americans. That's the enterovirus. It's now confirmed in 43 states, I believe it is, and over 500 cases or so. And now we have the 4-year-old New Jersey preschooler the first confirmed death, really, from the virus. And what's interesting is that apparently, he died. He went to sleep without any symptoms, and died that night. Now, is that a surprise? What do we know about this?
Well, that's unusual, Jeff. If someone gets a viral illness, who feels perfectly well and just dies in their sleep, it can happen. There can be really acute respiratory distress. I don't know the case personally, but I've certainly seen situations where a child could feel reasonably well and get acute respiratory distress and die. The fact that if he died in his sleep, that's a different story, because that could be another mechanism. But getting back to the enterovirus D68, This is a serious situation, as you mentioned correctly. 43 states, close to 500 or over 500 cases, 590, I think it is, the last count. And it can be a serious disease, particularly for children who have a propensity to getting asthmatic symptoms when they get a viral infection. They can go into respiratory distress and really have a problem. And the recent reported deaths, I think, adds to that reality that this is a serious situation.
All right, Dr. Anthony Fauci of NIH, thanks as always.
Good to be with you.
And for all the recent attention on the Ebola cases in the U.S., the toll in West Africa continues to rise, with more than 3,400 people already dead. Jerome DeLay of the Associated Press has been chronicling the outbreak in Liberia for the past 2 weeks. He's now in Paris, and I spoke with him by Skype a short time ago. You wrote in a blog report that people in Liberia are facing a kind of war, but one in which they can't see the enemy. Explain what you mean by that. How is it playing out in homes and on the streets?
Well, the thing is, you know, as I said in the piece I wrote for the AP, is the biggest danger you face in a war zone is the enemy. And if you can't see it, you're in real trouble. In Monrovia and throughout the West African region, which is stricken by the Ebola virus, you cannot see the enemy. You cannot see the virus per se. You just see what it does to people and the destruction that, you know, is happening all around it. And in that sense, it is, I think, a very, very dangerous thing as a journalist to cover. But also it is a thing that, you know, is very difficult to control.
I know you were trying to look at survivors, at families of victims, and the issue of stigma that is still there. Tell us what you saw.
Well, I saw people who were actually surviving from the virus. I'll give you the example of Julius, who was a nurse and who actually treated people who were suffering from the virus and then got the virus himself and gave himself some IVs for a few days till he was admitted into the MSF clinic, and he survived and he's now a survivor of Ebola, which allows him to work and help other people the same way he was helped by some people to, you know, against the virus. The main thing I want to say, though, is that I spent a lot of time chasing ambulances, and there is a lot of people there who need equipment, who need material. You have just a few ambulances in Monrovia, and when they go and ask for PPE suits, protective equipment, all they get is a pair of gloves and a pair of boots, and that makes their work very, very, very difficult and extremely dangerous.
So you're not seeing enough resources on the ground. I know you've covered a lot of wars and other things in Africa. How does this compare in terms of what you do see?
Well, what you see is actually the danger is from what you do not see. But in terms of resources, yes, MSF is on the ground and they're doing a tremendous job with the assets they have try to stop the virus. But I'll give you just one simple example. I went out for a day with an ambulance crew. They had an assignment to pick up 15 potential Ebola victims. They went to the Ministry of Health to get some gear, PPE suits, to get boots and so forth. Three of them in the ambulance, they were given two pairs of gloves and one pair of boots. And so they had to go and beg other places and try to locate the proper gear so they could do the job safely. And these are people who are dedicated, and these are people who are really working very hard to try to stop the spreading of the disease. But if you don't give them the means to do it properly, we've got a big problem.
All right. Jerome DeLay of the Associated Press, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
As the fall football season heats up, the Friday night lights dimmed somewhat last week with news that three young players died from injuries sustained on the field. Tom Cuginella, a 16-year-old, collapsed following a blocking collision during a game in Elwood, New York. 17-year-old DeMario Harris Jr. was pronounced dead 3 days after collapsing during a game. He's believed to have suffered a brain aneurysm shortly after making a tackle. That same night, 17-year-old Isaiah Langston collapsed during a warm-up before playing for Rollsville High School in North Carolina. Our student reporting labs train young people in public media journalism. They went to the football team at T.C. Williams High School in Virginia, which happens to include a female kicker, for reaction.
I like contact. I love hitting. I love hitting a football. That's one of the things that makes football great.
I like the contact. That's what it is.
When I had the first contact with someone, that like I felt like I had enough power to do what I want.
When I did kickoff last year, I obviously knew that I could be tackled. And then when it actually happened one time, I was completely shocked because I didn't know what it was truly going to feel like.
Coaches, you know, again, we talk about this in our meetings. We did early, and sometimes we've kind of neglected it in the past. But please make sure that because of these three deaths related to football, okay, and that's the most in a long period of time. With all the safety that's taking place now, you know, we play a game. We want to have fun. But we also want to make it safe. We want you to play hard. We want you to hit hard. We want you to go after your opponent, tackle him, knock him to the ground if you're blocking him. But we want you to be safe about it. We're not saying kill the other player, you know, because that's not appropriate.
Fortunately, I've never worked with a kid that died. Those kind of things are tragic, you know, and certainly it affects us because I work with kids every day. And I really don't know how I would react to one of my players getting hit and dying from an injury related to the sport that it has been a part of my life, my whole life.
It'll definitely bring awareness to every football team across the nation because that's something that no team would ever want to have to deal with.
My mother, she just told me she heard about a kid that died on the field, and she said, like, you know that when you go out there and suit up, every time you suit up could be your last time. I said, yeah, I know that, but I said, it's not something you think about. And even when you do think about it, you dismiss it because those type of thoughts in your head make you second guess yourself.
When you hear about the stories coming out at the pro level, such as the NFL, what you hear a lot of former players say is that at the same time, we knew what we were getting into when we started to play football. And that's, I think, one of the things that you have to consider if you want to play football.
My mom just really, she thinks twice about signing the paper when she has to. So she really signs it because she realized that football helps me keep my grades up and I wouldn't be doing the wrong things outside of school.
You can go to a doctor and get cleared from a concussion and walk home and drop dead from a concussion. I know that we've had people that got released from the hospital and say that we could play, and then they show up here at practice and they're good to go, and all of a sudden they're getting headaches and dizziness and throwing up, you know, 2 days after they've been cleared to play.
Bend your foot up towards you.
I would not want to be an athletic trainer. Coaching football is hard enough. Being a trainer is much harder than being a football coach.
It's usually pretty clear, to be honest, based off of even just their signs and symptoms. So typically, if it's not one of those clear situations, we will still keep them out of activity and we will reevaluate. And of course, always make sure the parents are aware of what they're looking for as well. So that way we have numerous eyes helping us to determine if it's something we need to be worried about and end up treating as a concussion. When I first came, I did not know how to tackle at all. And so if I was put in that position, I probably wouldn't have known what to do in the first place. So the fact that they take, especially at our school, they take time to show each one of us how to tackle so that we don't injure ourselves, like heads up, things like that. And so that's definitely something that I think every player should know, even if you're playing peewee or if you're in college. Like, it's something that you should always go over. Honestly, I personally would like to see the change of youth football to the full contact starting a bit later, just because of the higher risk of the younger kids doing head-related impacts. And it's showing now that later on in their life, it's taking a toll on their brain health in general. And I think we might need to start getting those youth football kids working more on technique and skill as opposed to full contact game situations.
I think they're going to put a lot of stipulations on the game that's going to make the game a lot less fun for some people. They're going to be very safe with their hits, and it's not going to have that freedom that the game once had, even though it did cause injuries and long-term injuries. But while we're in the moment, we're not really thinking about that. And I'm just like, there's a point where you got to let people live a little bit. Because we know what we're doing every time we come out here. We sign the emergency contact forms. We sign all that. We know what can happen. So while I'm out here, just let me do what I do.
For more on the risks to young athletes, we turn to Stephen Broglio. He's associate professor and director of the NeuroSport Research Laboratory at the University of Michigan and a leading voice for the National Athletic Trainers Association about the management of concussions. Stephen Broglio, when we listen to these students talk, do we know if they are more vulnerable than we have seen with the NFL or the NCAA?
Thanks for having me on, Gwen. You know, the first thing I think we look at is the epidemiology data that shows that the incidence rate for concussion at the NFL, the college, and the high school level is all about the same. So the same percentage of athletes will have an injury at all those levels. What really differs, though, is the number of athletes that participate in those sports each year. So at the professional level, we have about 1,500 athletes to play, about 40,000 at the college level, but we have about 1.2 million high school kids that play football each year.
Well, that's a big difference, and they're obviously a lot younger. They're under someone else's guardianship still, so that's what causes the extra concern. How does one lessen the risk to these young people?
You know, really, it comes down to good fundamentals, so good coaching techniques, heads-up football, seeing what you hit, as well as educating the athletes on what the signs and symptoms of concussion are. You're never going to reduce all concussions or eliminate all concussions from the game, but we can certainly reduce them. But when they happen, we need the athletes to report those to a coach or an athletic trainer if they're available at the practice or the game.
I've talked to young football players who say, oh, this is just what happens. They speak proudly of being clocked, of having their bell rung. Is this just a culture of playing hurt?
I think it was a culture of playing hurt. Certainly things have started to change. We've seen a time 10, 15 years ago where there was a big emphasis on pushing through it, pushing through the injury, playing while you're injured. But now I think with increased attention both through research, through media awareness, people are starting to understand the injury better. Athletes are reporting the injury more often. They're taking it seriously. They're seeking medical attention, and they're getting treatment as needed.
How do we know that the deaths we heard about last week or the incidents we heard about on the field are all related to play, and how much of it are things that can be screened for, like cardiac problems in advance, for instance?
Certainly. So I'm not familiar with any of the cases that were talked about. So there are certain things that can be screened for. There are certain cardiac issues that can be. There's certain brain issues that can be screened for. I believe one case might be related to an aneurysm. The question is the cost of those screenings and versus the associated risk that might happen. So aneurysms, and particularly in youth, are incredibly rare. And so the idea of screening the entire population may be cost prohibitive.
NCAA has a reporting mechanism, a mandatory reporting rule. Do high schools?
So every state in the country has a law on concussions that the athletes should be reporting the injury to an athletic trainer if they're available, or a coach, or another medical professional if they're available.
And what do parents do? What do parents say in this situation? We heard the young man say his mother reluctantly signs the paper when he brings it to her. Should parents be thinking maybe this is a bad idea? Football?
I don't think so. I think the benefits that young people get from participating in sports, whether it's football or soccer or anything, far outweigh the risks that they might have or might incur with a concussion. I mean, one concussion that's well managed, we have no evidence that suggests that there's going to be long-term problems in 20 years or 30 years. But yet we know that there are plenty of risks associated with not participating in physical activity, obesity, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and all the things that go along with that. And that's just on the medical side. We know that participation in sports develops work ethic, working as a team. There's huge benefits to physical activity and performance in school. So I think the benefits of sport participation far outweigh those risks.
It is definitely a trade-off on many, many different levels. Stephen Broglio, the University of Michigan Neurosports Research Laboratory, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Gwen.
Next, magical fantasy isn't just for young readers. Millions of adults are avid fans of a new twist to the genre. Jeffrey Brown is back with our book conversation.
Quentin did a magic trick. Nobody noticed. The first line of what's grown into a series of fantasy tales called the Magician Trilogy. But while filled with echoes of such classics as The Chronicles of Narnia and Harry Potter, these books are aimed more at an adult audience. The final chapter, The Magician's Land, has just been released. Author Lev Grossman is also the book critic for Time magazine and joins us now. And welcome to you.
Thank you.
Is it true that you explicitly wanted to start with classics like Narnia and Harry Potter and kind of play with them and make them into something for adults?
Well, I love those books. I've always loved them, and I continue.
Even as a kid?
Even as a child, mm-hmm. I loved Narnia, and then later Harry Potter. And, you know, when I was a writer in my 30s, I was still very attached to those books, but also very aware of how different my life was than lives of the characters in those books. And I started to wonder if it would be possible to write a story like that about young people who are discovering they have power they didn't know they had or finding their way into a secret world. But to write it for adults in contemporary literary language and trying to kind of use those stories to talk about the kinds of issues we struggle with as adults. Well,
so what are the main challenges that you found in that? For one thing, you have to give them, they suffer the indignities of adults, right, in their current world.
Very much
like
so.
Like car payments and things like that.
They don't have car payments. I don't subject them to that.
Right.
But they have drinking problems.
Yes.
They have sex lives.
Right.
They get depressed. The most important thing, I think, to me was that I didn't want there to be any kind of a Dumbledore in these books. I didn't want there to be the sort of avuncular advisor who, when these wizards strayed off the path, would sort of say, oh, no, back over here. That's the bad guy. You go fight him. I felt very lost in my life when I was writing these books, and I wanted to write a book about people who were lost in that way, and I didn't want them to have a Gandalf at their shoulder and saying, you know, this is what you do. These characters, they don't know what to do. They don't know who to fight, and they don't know where to go. They have to figure it out for themselves.
And, of course, there's the whole idea of magic and what that is and what that means, right, and how you make that real enough for an adult audience.
Well, when you learn magic, you gain great power, and I thought it was important that you have to give a lot. I didn't want this to be something that could be taught to school children and schools. I wanted it to be a little bit wilder than that and a little bit more demanding, a little bit more sort of raw.
Did you know where this was going from the beginning? I mean, was it conceived as a trilogy with a beginning, middle, and end?
It definitely had a beginning. I was quite lost when I started writing this book, and I couldn't even look that far ahead.
Well, explain that, because I've read that you've talked about being depressed, in a state of depression at that time.
I struggled with depression, and I felt very powerless in myself, and I wanted to, almost by writing this story about a guy who discovers that he can do magic, I was almost trying to figure out how to find my own voice as a writer and to find a sense of power as a person. Because I felt so unmagical and the world felt so unenchanted to me. I had to find my way to a place where I felt like there was a little bit of magic in my life.
So you draw that direct line between your own depression and the writing of the book.
I was always struck as a kid, you know, when the Pevensies in Narnia, when they grow up, they kind of lose magic and they lose Narnia when they get interested in adult things. Mm-hmm. And I felt there must be some magic to being a grown-up, and it would be a rich and weird and complicated magic, different from the kind of magic you read about in those books, but it must be there somewhere, and I sort of tried to create it.
Did you or do you still worry about not being taken seriously as a writer of genre fiction? I mean, I'm thinking of you in your Time magazine hat, where you're running in kind of high literary circles in some ways, or certainly any of the books you're coming across, and no doubt the authors.
Yeah, it's true. Fantasy doesn't get the kind of respect that literary fiction does. But, you know, we live in a culture that is so hungry for stories. People love them, and people in particular are interested, I think, in magic. So when you write fantasy, it's true, the tiny subculture that is sort of literary New York doesn't care that much. But there's so many millions of people who do. You definitely, there's no lack of respect out there for fantasy writers. Maybe it's not that particular kind, it's not the Pulitzer kind, but it's pretty good.
I talk to a lot of authors here, and there's often this subject comes up of the future of the book and writing and who are we writing for kind of thing. Are you sanguine? I mean, you're doing well, so you must be feeling like somebody's out there reading, right?
I think this is a great time to be writing and to be reading novels. I think we spent a lot of time in the shadow of modernism, of Faulkner and Woolf and Joyce and Kafka, these writers who were very difficult, wrote these very deconstructed plots, which was important, I think, at that time. And I still love those books very, very much. But I think novelists are kind of rediscovering storytelling. They're rediscovering the power of plot. They're rediscovering all these things that genre writers have known for a long time, fantasy writers, science fiction writers, romance writers, that you can write these powerful stories, and there's such powerful ways of expressing yourself. I feel like all novelists, including literary novelists, are kind of coming back to that, and it makes the novel accessible in a way that is just wonderful. I don't see a downside to it.
All right. We'll continue this discussion online, okay? For now, the book is The Magician's Land, Lev Grossman. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Finally tonight, President Lyndon Johnson was not the only member of his family to become a champion of civil rights. Lady Bird Johnson undertook her own campaign to save the landmark law, a whistle-stop tour of the South that began 50 years ago today. Judy Woodruff has that lesser-known part of the story.
I'm going into the South on this whistle-stop trip because I am proud of the South, and I am proud that I am part of the South.
In October 1964, less than a month before the presidential elections, Lady Bird Johnson boarded a train in Washington to stump through 8 southern states. It was a gamble to help win back disaffected southern Democrats to President Lyndon Johnson's camp after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. The president's aides were not sold on the usefulness of such a trip, according to historian Mark Updegrove, director of the Johnson Presidential Library.
The president's advisors dissuaded Lady Bird Johnson from making the trip through the South because they thought the southern states were a lost cause. But Lady Bird and Lyndon Johnson felt it was very important as southerners to state their case to their fellow southerners, even if they didn't vote for them.
Lady Bird was joined on the train for part of the trip by the Johnsons' then 20-year-old daughter, Linda.
Well, Mother very much wanted to do the whistle stop tour because she wanted the people of the South to know that even if they didn't agree with everything that Daddy had done, and the Civil Rights Bill was one of those things, that we loved the South, and we felt she felt herself very much a part of the South because her family had come from Alabama. She wanted everybody to know that she wanted their votes and that we wanted the South to know that we respected them and we thought that they were worthy of our attention.
Over a 4-day period, she spoke to crowds that gathered at railroad stations in 47 cities from Virginia to New Orleans.
It was the first, if one of the first trips where a first lady campaigned without her husband. And I think that's something to be said in Mother's favor. Mother did not like public speaking. She took a course to try to conquer her fears because she just felt nervous.
Her safety and that of her staff was a constant worry.
There were great security concerns along the nearly 1,700-mile journey through the South. There were a number of bomb threats, and there was such concern among the Secret Service that there was a car that preceded the Lady Bird special, so that if there was a bomb on the tracks, it would affect the car in front of the Lady Bird special and not the Lady Bird special itself.
Indeed, some towns were not always welcoming.
There were epithets thrown at Lady Bird Johnson throughout the trip. There were placards that people held up, some that said things like, "Blackbird, go home."
My friends, this is a country of many viewpoints, and I respect your right to express your own. Now it's my turn to express mine. Thank you.
She didn't bait them. She didn't fuss at them. She didn't rise to their level. But she spoke from her heart.
The 500,000 people who crowded the stations to hear Mrs. Johnson were not all opponents by any account.
We also need to think about all the heroic people from those towns who came out and witnessed, knowing that on Sunday they'd be going back to their church and some of their friends would be saying, we were going to come through that little town or that big town or wherever, and then we're leaving. But they were going to be there all the time. They were going to be staying there and facing, for good or bad, the people who post their views.
When the Lady Bird special arrived in New Orleans, LBJ was waiting. And later, it appeared the trip may have paid off politically.
The Lady Bird special traveled through 8 states, only 3 of which Lyndon Johnson got in the 1964 landslide election. He was actually surprised that he got Florida and Virginia. He also got North Carolina, which he largely expected. But I think it was a successful journey because it showed the South that the president and first lady still cared about them.
With her husband at her side, Lady Bird told the crowd in New Orleans, "I am aware that there are those who would exploit the South's past troubles to their own advantage, but I do not believe that the majority of the South wants any part of the old business."
Again, the major developments of the day. The Supreme Court refused to take up gay marriage this term, rejecting appeals by 5 states. And President Obama said the government may upgrade Ebola screening for airline passengers, even as he played down chances for an outbreak inside the United States. On the NewsHour Online right now, we have a report from El Salvador, where a violence protection prevention program modeled after one begun in Phoenix has succeeded in helping to curb the flow of child migrants crossing the border. And there's still more local authorities can do to prevent gang violence. Read about that from our partners at Fronteras on The Rundown. All that and more is on our website, newshour.pbs.org. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. On Tuesday, what's that giant face on the mall in Washington? We look at how one artist is using the national landmark as his own temporary canvas. I'm Gwen Ifill. We'll see you online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thank you and good night.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by BNSF Railway. And by BAE Systems. Inspired work.
And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting science, technology, and improved economic performance and financial literacy in the 21st century.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.